Extra Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 223, Tara Forces Dave to watch Alice, season 6, episode 10, The Wild One. I am Son of Anarchy, David T. Cole, and I'm here with my old lady, Tara Ariano.
Yep.
You want to take a second crack at that
one? Sure.
If you could go back in time and do something for my old lady, Tara, what would that be?
I was going to try and imitate the vibrations, but I don't... Let's do that. Welcome to Extra, Extra Hot, Great for Another Week. Patreons, thank you so much for your support and for making this podcast possible. We are sadly without Sarah. She will be back very soon. And since it was just me and Dave, Dave had the idea that we should each do a foresening on one another. And I suggested the theme Dry January, because that's the thing. Dave, have you heard of Dry January before?
Is that like you don't drink?
Yes.
Okay.
You don't drink booze. You're allowed to drink other stuff.
Yeah, okay.
And so I thought that was open-ended enough that, you know, dry can take you lots of places.
Sure.
I was taken directly to Phoenix, Arizona for an episode of Alice. And I knew, because this was a show that was on from 1976 until like the mid-80s, that there was going to be some interesting people in the guest cast. I went straight to IMDb. I searched for, went past the people that played themselves, like Joel Grey in a two-parter, apparently.
Wow.
And people like Debbie Reynolds, who, you know, played a character but would have no resonance, particularly for Dave, although he does like love Mother. Tastes like an orange foot. Yeah. I landed on this one, season 6, episode 10, The Wild One, because it features two...
No, don't say who.
I'm not, okay. But it's because of the guest cast.
I see.
And that's how we got here.
All right. Fair enough. Well, just to fill you in case you're not super old like I am, it is, in fact, based on the movie Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
Loosely.
Which I've never seen, but I assume it's about a poor guy who moves into Alice Cooper's old home. And then all of his fans keep coming over to see Alice. And he's like, ugh, Alice doesn't live here anymore. Over and over again. It really doesn't sound like enough meat for a Martin Scorsese movie, which apparently this is.
It is. It's a lovely movie. It's like, it is about a woman named Alice who like gets divorced and starts her life over with her kid in a new town. But it's not like wacky. It's a dramedy. It's not as cuckoo as this.
Yeah, it was the 70s. People were too busy worrying about quicksand to notice these things. So
true.
We're good. So the setup is that Alice, and the TV show, is that Alice is a recent widow from New Jersey, decides she's going to go to L.A. to finally pursue that singing career. She has her son Tommy in tow. Her husband is a trucker who died in an accident, I think, in the show. Her dreams apparently are only as good as her car, which breaks down in Phoenix, Arizona, America's magnifying glass on an ant. And I guess she's like, well, fuck it. That's it for my dreams, because she just becomes a waitress at Mel's Diner for 9 years before trying again, I guess.
Yes, correction. She is a widow in the movie as well. Sorry.
Okay. Today's episode is from season 6 of those 9 seasons, and it aired December 27th, 1981, Boxing Day.
Crazy to think that a network show would show a new episode in Christmas
in the liminal space between...
That's right.
Christmas and New Year's. Yeah, it is weird. You may know Alice from Flo, the sassy waitress who had the catchphrase, kiss my grits!
Mm-hmm.
She has left by this time. She went
sure
on
has.
To star in her one-season wonder Flo spinoff, which came and went by the time this episode had aired.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings me up to this point.
Yep.
When I was a kid, I would watch this show because it was on TV.
Same.
And I knew that Kiss My Grits was something a little naughty, but I didn't know what. And I thought that grits were like some sexual organ or something. So for the longest time, I didn't want anything. I mean, the people would all then talk about, I love grits. And I'm like, I don't know what grits are. I can't figure it out. I don't know where the Venn diagram between Kiss My Grits and grits. And like, I think I might have been over 10 by the time somebody sat down and explained like actually what grits were.
Wow.
And they were made
out of... like a very serious conversation.
Great. I mean... I might have thought grits were nipples or something, maybe. Like, I'm not sure. And
Dave,
right now,
you're
I'm
10
not...
years old. It's time you learned what grits are. Turn the TV off. Listen to me. This is important.
I am being completely honest, I know grits are made of corn.
Yeah.
But it's all I really can figure out about grits. I've never really looked into it because I've always had this weird sort of comfortable distance from the word grits that I don't feel like I should ever close.
Yeah, I've never had grits either. We both grew up in, you know, Canada,
sure,
where they are not part of like the traditional diet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you can find it in places, but it's not like, but it's like a mushy sort of oatmeal-y thing. People make them with cheese. That's literally all I know. That and the scene in My Cousin Vinny where grits, the length of time it takes to cook them, is pivotal to the plot.
I see. Well, grits sound disgusting.
Yeah, they're not for me, and I like
either
oatmeal.
Real or Alice grits. I don't know. So by this time, Flo's out. Her grits are out. There's no kissing of grits.
No.
Jolene is her replacement, and we see her in this episode. So let me just run down this episode as it starts with Jolene. I'll run it down. This episode starts in the diner. And Jolene is nervously refilling the coffee cups of two, I was going to say it, ne'er-do-wells.
Yep.
A scrawny one
who
disrespectfully is putting his foot up over the back of a chair.
Mm-hmm.
And a leather-bound biker trying, but I'm going to say not succeeding, to emulate Marlon Brando in The Wild One, which is also the title of this episode.
Sure.
Or like maybe this played differently in 1981, but the world was a different place where, you know, gangs of young men wearing matching jackets were a thing to be feared. I don't know. Also in 1981, maybe the world didn't know they had nothing to fear from the actor who played Bones, the biker dude who looked like Marlon Brando, played by babyface Jay Leno.
That's right.
The menace that is Jay Leno.
Mm-hmm.
As your feared biker type.
Yep.
Now, it's a weird little moment because biker gangs in the 70s were well into Hell's Angels as like the biker gang type, right? Mm-hmm. But this is like a 50s biker gang has invaded Mel's Diner. Like this is straight from The Wild Ones kind of look.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know what that, Mutt from fucking Indiana Jones. Same thing, right? They're all the same thing.
Yes.
So this is one of a handful of TV roles that Leno had before his stand-up career took off. He didn't have a lot. He had one episode of Good Times, one episode of One Day at a Time. And in between those two, he played gas station attendant in Holmes and Yo-Yo.
Okay.
Do you know what this show is?
No.
A detective named Holmes. Shocker.
Sure. Yes.
His partner is Yo-Yo, a 1970s android.
Oh, boy.
And the android is just the person who has, like, a cutout box of wires and shit on his chest.
Have you tried to find this show on the internet?
Oh, yeah, you can totally watch it. We can definitely do an episode of this sometime.
Okay.
Okay.
Good.
It is up there with famous what-the-fuck 70s concepts, for sure. So we got Leno there. His scrawny mate is Muttner, played by none other than Ron Polillo.
Mm-hmm.
2 years after his four-year stint as Arnold Horshack on Welcome Back, Kotter.
Boy.
Here he is playing the second half of the to-be-feared biker gang that has invaded Mel's Diner here in Phoenix, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
So to recap, the diner is on edge because Horshack and Jay Leno are eating lunch in it.
They are being very rude.
They are being very rude. Even though they're on edge, Jolene makes a lot of short height jokes at Muttner's expense. That is like the extent of the pushback for these bikers.
Yeah. Mel, by the way, of Mel's, the eponymous Mel of diner fame, could easily, he's an older guy, but he's barrel chested. Like he could shove either of these guys out very easily if like trouble came.
I may be confusing him with the skipper from Gilligan's Island, but I feel like he has a Navy background.
I'm sure that's true.
Right? Like he feels like that kind of character. Like he's on a PT boat in the war. And
yes.
Somewhere he's got a chest full of Nazi shit that he's from people he killed or something.
For
like
sure.
That.
If that's not show canon, that's the vibe.
That is the vibe. Yeah.
So, you know, it's very funny that he is like mostly hanging back, being scared of these bikers.
Yeah. Even though Jillian's refilling the coffee, this is Alice's table. And right off the bat, when she goes to the table, we discover just how evil and vile these bikers are.
Yes, gents. What can I do for you?
Yeah. Clean up this mess, bimbo.
The name is Alice.
Oh, excuse me. Bimbo Alice.
Anything else I can get you?
Yeah, you could get us a couple of burgers to go.
How do you like them?
You mean besides raw?
Two patties to go, hold the heat.
Alice, come here. Make sure that trash over there doesn't walk off with my silverware.
Mel, they didn't use silverware.
How'd they eat the mashed potatoes and the gravy?
You don't want to know.
Here's where I give this episode one of its very few kudos, which is in the 70s, continuity was not really a big concern for most television programs. But at the beginning of this episode, we are treated to Horshack two-fingering his mashed potatoes without the camera being directly on him. So it was kind of a little Easter egg you can go back to and see if he is. He's like scooping up the mashed potatoes and gravy, shoving it in his mouth. That all actually happened on camera, which is not usually the case. They would have a joke, but not necessarily deliver the goods for it. So that was the other thing, though, that, you know, I guess because it's the past and it was a different time.
Sure.
There were a lot of signifiers of menace that I didn't really take as menace, but were, I believe, meant to signal that. And one of them is actually ordering a raw burger, which I thought was going to be a setup for some sort of joke that comes on. But they do make and bag him a couple hamburgers uncooked. And I guess that just means he's like really tough. This is the Mel's Diner version of dry swallowing pills.
I mean, my first thought about that is like, was this what they did instead of, you know, the takeaway pizzas that would, you know, when you get the pizza that you bake at home? Like, are they going to barbecue these later? But they're going to be out on their bikes. Like,
yeah, I don't think the bikers really do anything for themselves in that way, right? I mean, that's the lifestyle. Yes. You just have other people do whatever. Sometimes you pay, sometimes you don't. You know what I mean? You just get by whatever. You know, you're hand to mouth all the time, right? All right. Well, Vera, who is the third of the waitresses, and she is the dumb one in the series, is carefully watching Butner, that's Horshack, but for different reasons than Mel.
Hey, what are you staring at?
Your tattoo.
Yeah, what about it?
I don't think I've ever seen a cobra eating a police car before.
And here's the big kudos.
Yeah.
They actually show the tattoo. You can see it from the long shots that he has a wrist-to-shoulder application. And then they'd show a close-up of his shoulder. And it is a cobra with a full police car in its mouth.
Yeah.
And it is one of the best visuals I've ever seen from a TV show. It is really good. Kudos to the artist who did that. The concept is ridiculous. Everything about it was great. It was definitely my favorite part of the episode.
Yeah, which is weird because I feel like if that were a joke in like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, for example, you would see it from a distance. You would see that the character had the tattoo. You would, that joke would be in it, but you would not get the like smash cut to the close up. They would just, they would leave it to your imagination. Yeah. But this is like, no, it's the 70s. If we reference this, people are going to want to see it. And I did.
And it was good. I don't know how much white ink tattooing was being done in the 70s because it was definitely just face paint as a tattoo. But it still worked on me. I really enjoyed it. If you look at the album, the cover art for this episode right in your podcast player, that's what I chose for it. It's not a picture of Jay Leno.
No.
It's not a picture of Alice.
No.
It's a cobra eating a police car. You're welcome.
Also, a second correction. I know I said it's the 70s. It's 1981, but it's the 70s.
You're right.
It feels like the 70s.
It's the, I mean, the truest thing about the 80s, sort of like when the aesthetic actually did change, if it ever really changed from the 70s in a meaningful way, is that the 80s aren't blue and purple neon and grids and weird shapes. That's like 87, 88 kind of, or 86 to 88 kind of thing. At this point in time, everything is still brown and an ashtray. In 1981. That's just like the way everything was.
Yeah.
All right. So back to the show. After harassing all the waitresses again, the bikers make a big display of littering the table and floor with napkins from the Mel's Diner napkin dispensers. And these napkins are lettuce green colored, all of them. Colored toilet paper, colored napkins. Where did they go?
Yeah.
Alice then appeals to Mel for relief.
Can't you do anything about them?
Forget it, Alice. I mean, those guys are like two time bombs ready to explode. Always ticking, tick, tick, tick.
Probably not read to enough as children.
We're not talking about children, Vera. We're talking about punks. We're talking about slime. These guys are dangerous.
Really?
Yeah. A friend of mine got his nose busted by one of their kind. Just because he told them,
Have a nice day.
Really?
Yes.
Have a nice day. First of our very of the moment references and lines. So after this, Bones rips up the bill in a big display. Mel goes ballistic before quickly realizing who he's going ballistic in front of, backing down because of the tick, tick, tick time bomb of it all. Alice, however, gets mad at this whole situation. She's had enough. She runs. She blocks the door so they can't leave, demands payment. And Bones, impressed with her moxie, gets Muttner to pay with a big tip and promises to be back tomorrow, all while menacingly blocking her in with his armpit right in her nose, which was weird. That is the first commercial break. The next day, Mel is recounting recent events with Diner and series regular Henry. He is the workman for Bell Telephone. He's even got the logo and everything. Mm-hmm. And he has this conversation.
I say they're coming back, and we ought to get protected.
I may have something on my truck.
Like what?
I could hit him with a princess phone.
You're so stupid. That's not going to scare them away.
If only I'd brought a snapshot of my mother-in-law.
Princess phone? Real thing that Bell sold. Well, maybe they didn't sell it, but they rented to you because I don't think you could buy telephones back then still, or maybe it was just changing around now where you can actually buy a telephone and not rent it from Bell. But are you familiar with the princess phone, Tara?
Yes, of course.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that was what it was called, but it is the, you have your typical forever phone that we all had when we were growing up in the 70s and 80s. And then the princess phone is the oblong one where the receiver is the same length as the set that you put it on. Didn't look particularly heavy. I don't really know why it was the princess phone. I guess it's funny because it's got the word princess in it. Mm-hmm. Also, mother-in-law joke.
Yep.
The past. So, of course, Bones and Muttner return. Bones has some news, some exciting news for Alice.
I was thinking about yesterday. You were pretty frisky.
Yeah, well, I probably, you know, got carried away.
Whatever. Listen, I got your tattoos all picked out, okay? Picture this, a plane crashing into flames. Man, it'll look terrific right here on your...
What are you talking about?
Alice, I decided. You're my new old lady. Let's go!
Oh, dear. Now, the late 70s and early 80s were a different time, and bikers claiming waitresses was just the thing that happened and nobody talked about it. Weird vibe as soon as all this starts. It's always played for laughs, but like the reality is that would be so fucking bad for everybody involved and creepy that it's kind of hard to dismiss the whole concept for the sake of watching a sitcom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they get away with it because we know Alice is tough. We already saw her be tough earlier in the episode when she wouldn't let them leave without paying. But I agree with you. It's iffy.
Yeah. Then we learn Bones has a weird diet and something, again, I thought was a setup to a joke we're going to hear later, but this is the whole thing.
Hey, Popeye, how many boxes of steel wool pads you got?
I got a whole bunch in the storeroom.
Yeah, well, bring them all out here.
How come?
I use them as shredded wheat. It's good roughage.
This biker is so tough. How tough is he? This biker is so tough that he eats steel wool for breakfast.
Yeah.
What? Again, like, this is the thing that makes you tough.
Yeah.
And now we should be scared of him because this fucking guy, he's metal. So Alice is protesting in a roundabout way with two Bones with metaphors that definitely go over his head until it finally clicks.
You're starting to frustrate me, girl.
Listen, if I'm going to run off with a man, I need a better reason than he makes my skin crawl.
I'm wasting my time, huh?
Now you're getting the point.
Well, I understand. You don't want to go out with me.
Right.
Well, it may take me a while, but it finally sinks in.
Very good.
So what are we talking for? Let's go.
Ah! What? Ah!
Alice, take napkins. You can leave a paper trail.
The common element with all of Alice's friends is nobody directly helps her. And as we discover after we come back from the commercial break, nobody's called the cops and it's been 4 hours.
Yeah.
So what I'm learning is Alice has no good friends.
Or it's generally acknowledged Phoenix is a lawless hellscape. Yeah. He carries her out to the bike and like plops her on it.
Yeah. And then they slowly ride 10 feet to the edge of the soundstage they're at.
Yes. Yeah. The whole episode takes place on the one set. It's like this, it's the inside of the diner and then just outside. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's all we see. Yeah. Just, it's crazy to remember how cheap sitcoms used to be.
Yeah. So back from break, it's 4 hours later. Alice bursts back into the diner. She's wearing Bones' leather jacket and involuntarily bouncing up and down in a way that I wasn't really sure what happened to her. Again, I guess it's because she was on a motorcycle, but I thought the worst of it. But nevertheless, here is that scene. We pick up where we were in the intro clip.
Did he lay a finger on you, Alice?
No. We fortunately never got to the second stage of initiation.
What is that?
I'm not allowed to tell you. If I do, I have to go directly to the third stage, which begins with stapling my earrings on.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
Mm-hmm.
So she recounts a bad tale of a trip to the Grand Canyon and back within 4 hours, including a stop through a 7-Eleven for hors d'oeuvres. She explains that she actually escaped.
Sit for 2 minutes and then go back to work.
Ignore mail. We're just all glad it's over.
Yeah, but see, I'm not sure it is. You don't understand. He didn't let me get away. I escaped.
Gee, this story has more twists in it than Dallas.
Dallas, it's the 70s, it's the 80s, Dallas is big, Dallas.
Yeah.
So, of course, the bikers are back, Muttner's back, Bones is back, they return to retrieve Alice, but Daisy, Bones' current old lady, is here to fight for him. Alice talks Daisy down eventually, all the girls, the waitresses, and Daisy talk about shitty men in their lives, and then Daisy agrees to talk it out with Bones.
Good for you, Daisy. Couples should get their problems right out front and really discuss it together.
How do you know?
I saw it on Phil Donahue.
It's the 70s and 80s. It's Phil Donahue. So Daisy and Bones get back together. Muttner steps on a cover booster seats to forcibly kiss Jolene at the end just because. And the waitresses literally throw him out of the diner. And that's how this weird episode ends.
Yeah. I love the part where the big reunion of Daisy and Bones comes when she gets him to agree to drop the dress code of their motorcycle gang. And the studio audience applauds them making up, but in a very tentative way. They're like,
ooh,
not so sure about it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, weird episode.
It is weird.
It definitely is. Like, it feels like the writing room was definitely old.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we wouldn't have the storyline today of kidnapping women and forcibly making them join your gang.
Yeah.
I don't really think they successfully did a 1980 take on it.
No.
Again, this is not the greatest time for chivalrous biker gang culture in America. Not particularly funny. Really only notable for its guest stars playing against type.
Mm-hmm.
Not really playing into their strengths as actors, I'm going to say.
Mm-mm.
I mean, I understand that Muttner's supposed to be kind of a weaselly, sure, whatever you say, biker version of the dogs from Looney Tunes. Not menacing in the least bit.
No.
Weird, weird episode of television, Tara.
Yeah, it was especially weird for me to watch it the same week that I rewatched the Quantum Leap episode that we're going to be talking about on the Patreon for Again With This, which is also revolving around bikers, although actually a 50s biker gang in the 50s.
Right.
It's pivotal in that episode as well that the head of the biker gang, who wears the same kind of little stupid hat as Bones here and as Mutt and as Marlon Brando in The Wild One, there's also, it's a plot skein that like he has issues around consent with women, but that one is much more rough because it's a, you know, it's a drama,
right?
But also a silly drama. But yeah, this continued to be a concern through, like, from, you know, the when this aired in 81 to 90 when that episode aired, is like this was clearly it was the quicksand of its day, perhaps. People were worried anytime you stop at a diner you might run afoul of a motorcycle gang and not yet have any recourse, because they're not all nice like Fonzie. Some of them are mean.
Yeah, you don't want to go on Route 66 at night.
No.
You may never be seen again. And this is what happened to you. You get abducted. Yeah, you're really right. It's killer bees, quicksand, yeah. Mm-hmm. Airplanes falling out of the sky.
Yeah.
And biker gangs taking your woman.
Yeah. This is what people were worrying about before they knew they should be worried about AIDS.
Ancient astronaut theorists say yes.
This is the Extra Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 224. Dave forces Tara to watch Ancient Aliens, season 13, episode 5, The Desert Codes. I am Desert Line Sniffer David T. Cole. And I'm here with Stonewall That at Ground Level Has No Purpose, Tara Ariano.
But from above.
All right, we're talking about ancient aliens. That means it's time to see if Tara still remembers all the cosmic answers asked in the credits of Ancient Aliens. Tara, can you say them without prompting?
Mm-hmm. Aliens.
Uh-huh.
Gold.
Yeah.
Us.
Uh-huh.
They're still here.
And?
I just said they're still here.
Nicely done. Without prompting, that's how much we've done it before. She doesn't even need to hear the questions. Who are they? Why are they here? Where did they go? Will they come back? And what did they leave behind? Nicely done. Dry January here on Extra Extra Hot Great continues for my forcing to Tara. I have chosen Ancient Aliens, season 13, episode 5, The Desert Codes. All about how aliens and deserts and humanity coexisted, I guess.
Yeah.
Ancient Aliens, one of my favorite stupid shows. I pity people that watch it. And I've met some people that watched it and believe that stuff.
Oh, dear.
And it's really sad. Mm. I always enjoy Ancient Aliens, a show that if it was addressed would have seams that were 3 feet wide. And that's why I love it so. So, Tara, walk us through Ancient Aliens, The Desert Codes.
Okay, I'm going to do my best. I have a lot of clips. So let's start at the beginning with the story that opens the episode, clip one.
Saudi Arabia, 2004. While exploring the ancient lava fields of Harat Kaibar, amateur archaeologist Dr. Abdullah Al Said comes upon a number of what appear to be stone walls, each approximately 3 feet high. From the ground level, Dr. Al Said concludes that the structures have no discernible pattern or purpose. That is, not until 4 years later, when he obtains satellite photos of the very same area. What he sees astounds him. There, detectable from the sky, are a vast collection of more than 400 stone enclosures. Known to the local Bedouin as the works of the old men, these mysterious structures are quickly examined and are revealed to stretch for hundreds of miles.
Okay. So most geoglyphs are in deserts. So this selection meets our dry January brief perfectly. I understand why Dave picked it. And at the end of this, we see obviously lots of B-roll of what they're describing. So we get the author of a book called Earth Grids telling us somewhat whimsically.
Kiss my grids.
telling us whimsically, the shapes widen at one end. Like runways, which that runways don't do that. They're straight. They only look like that if you have been tricked by a child's perspective drawing into thinking that's what shape they are. They're not like flattened triangles. They're straight.
Ancient astronaut theories say yes.
Yeah. So we continue. At issue are these rectilinear enclosures with a round enclosure at one end. Clip two.
Although no record exists indicating when these structures were built, who built them, or why, the predominant theory among mainstream archaeologists is that they were constructed for hunting purposes many thousands of years ago.
What we think they are prehistoric hunting sites where gazelle and other animals would be driven into the enclosure, and then on the outsides of the enclosure pits were dug and the animals would fall into the pits. The kites, when you visit them on the ground, are really hard to find. In the air, you get the whole pattern. There are literally thousands of them. And they must have been in use for thousands of years. And why did they fall into disuse? That's an answer we haven't yet got.
Although the theory that the stone structures were used for hunting purposes is compelling, ancient astronaut theorists argue that if these structures were really used for hunting gazelle, the walls would have needed to be more than 3 feet high, since a gazelle can leap more than 10 feet into the air.
Okay, first of all, what we know about the ground, especially in the desert, is it doesn't ever change. No. Certainly not over thousands of years.
It's really hard and resistant to wind.
It really is. So the voice that we hear, not the narrator, the expert, is an aerial archaeologist from Oxford giving the real, one assumes, explanation for what these structures were for, immediately undercut by both the narrator and then a series of the show's cast of crackpots being like, yeah, but what if? Like, for example, clip 3.
But why would ancient people, in so many different locations around the world, all be making signs that can only be seen from above?
We don't know for sure what ancient peoples were trying to communicate through geoglyphs, but the most important thing is the amount of time and effort that went into building them. They're not quick sketches. They're, many of them, whole community projects. And the time that you spend working on them is time not spent gathering food, not spent defending your land. It's time not spent looking after your children. So the first thing that they communicate is to the community itself, what is important to the community.
But could there be another, even more incredible explanation?
I hope so.
Is it possible that these ancient geoglyphs were created not for a terrestrial purpose, but for an extraterrestrial one? Ancient astronaut theorists say yes, and suggest further clues can be found by examining similar shapes and symbols that occur on a much smaller scale.
Ancient astronaut theorists never say no. They always say yes. Mm-hmm. So note how the real archaeologist, this is another actual academic, when he's describing these structures, keeps saying the first thing that they teach us, we never cut back to him to hear the rest of his list. So the effect is nothing could motivate a whole community of ancient people to make art except aliens told them to. Like, that's how this show works. It treats all of its experts the same. Like, the crazy ones should have to wear a special shirt, uh-huh. I feel, because by being cheek by jowl with the cuckoos, sure. Like, the real academics don't look any different from them. Like, Tara, all the other guys have to do is buy a jacket and a button-down shirt, and they look just as normal, I'm other than their turquoise jewelry.
Pleased as punch to tell you, they actually, all the crackpots are wearing their uniforms, and that is, if you look, they all have either a really ornate, stupid necklace,
yes,
or pin of some sort that You're tells right. you that they are, in fact, ancient alien astronaut theorist crackpots.
David Childress tries to fit in. He's trying to look normal, yeah. and I don't care for it, trying to fly under the radar like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he's a guy that looks like he's selling toilets.
He kind of looks like Buddy Garrity from Friday Night Lights, yeah. But not Southern.
There is no explanation for why they would spend so much time doing this, except for A, they want to eat animals.
Yeah.
Or B, they really want to stay in the good graces of their gods.
Yes.
If they're not hunting pens, which is the first example, and they're kind of like, the problem with this show is they never quite let you know when they're transitioning their thought process from one example to the other.
That's what I'm, yes.
Because
yes.
There is a baton exchange happening. Mm-hmm. Hasn't quite happened just yet.
Yeah.
But when they're getting into like, well, you know, you can tell the priorities of a civilization by what they spend their time on. Mm-hmm. And if they're worried about where the rain's coming next season, I'm going to guess they may carve out a little time to make a nice picture of a bird to please whoever they think is up there watching them.
Right.
But anyways, yes. Continue.
Yeah, exactly. This show is like, I was about to say it's like a 7-layer dip of crazy, but it's not. It's like when you're building with blocks and you can layer them like sort, you know, stack sort of diagonally where one is like kind of hanging off the end and then the next and then the next and then the next. And it gets more and more precarious where it's like, it might have a strong foundation, but the further you get from that foundation, the more likely it is to collapse.
Yeah, kind of. it's also kind of like a water wheel that's not attached to anything meaningful, where like it'll fill up and then like spill itself out, which usually would give you energy.
Yes.
But at this point, it just falls into a void because like what you'll notice in the next segment is right at the end of this one, they're like, all right, so Saudi Arabia's got these things. They're totally not hunting pens. They're definitely some sort of like pitcher or alien script or who knows what.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that because gazelles can jump really high. And what if a random fact from the next thing we're going to talk about proved something we just said? That is every transition they do.
That's right.
And it never connects. They never connect the dots.
No.
They never talk about hunting walls again.
No.
Nothing ever connects.
Nope.
And they've just done this from the very start. And every time I'm like, you magnificent bastards, how did you sell a TV show?
Yeah.
And it's been going on for so long.
Yeah.
It's great. I love it.
They're in season 19 currently.
It's great. All right. Continue.
Okay. So there are a few things going on. One is what the recurrence of particular symbols in petroglyphs and geoglyphs, like spirals or rectangles or mandalas or humanoid figures might mean. Geoglyphs are what they're talking about here, like the ones that are gigantic, cover like acres and acres of space. Yeah. Petroglyphs are just drawings on rocks, like smaller. Yeah. No mention is given to the fact that in both visual art and storytelling, some themes are common across all human experience, including into our day. So there's a lot of like, why would we see this spiral in Bolivia that we also see all the way over here in Saudi Arabia? And it's like, because that's a design that is pleasing to the eye.
And happens in nature.
Yeah. Let's hear from a local lunatic who apparently has no academic credentials, clip four.
One of the most interesting geoglyphs that you have at Nazca is the Sun-Star Cross geoglyph, which is really a very complicated, huge mandala of interconnected stars and triangles. And it's something we see all over the world, and in Tibet and India as mandalas and even yantras. So things like this that are so geometrically complicated and are found all over the world, indicates that there was some kind of worldwide symbolic language that was brought here by a higher intelligence, probably extraterrestrials.
Probably. That was our friend David Childress, by the way.
People used to be so dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, those Asian people. What a bunch of fucking morons. There's no way they could have figured out how to, you know, overlap things and ape locations of the stars that they see in the night sky every fucking night of their lives.
Yeah.
Like, there is so much Eurocentrism about this whole enterprise.
Yes.
Oh, those old brown people, they didn't know what they were doing. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of that in there.
Yeah.
But, like, just the hand-waving away of, you know what? There just was this moment where humans were dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, the next year, did you notice they were doing some really cool shit? I mean, that's just the way it was. So, probably aliens.
Yes. I mean, you've already said the thing that gets skipped over, or they'll give it lip service in like the first 10 minutes of the episode and then it never comes up again. It's like, these might have been for the benefit of, I don't want to say imaginary, but like celestial beings, the god, whatever gods these different, you know, tribes or cultures believed in. Mm-hmm. They're like, anything in the sky is an alien, period, end of story. Like, that's where ancient aliens theorists always go. There's no credit to like how cultures evolved that didn't involve
a
direct communication with like figures that came to these towns or villages and like passed on their knowledge.
There's no acknowledgement that human behavior as on a curve as we start to distinguish more things between magic and science.
Yes.
That changes your culture. Nope.
No,
it was
not
just,
at all.
It was just, we went from 0 to 100 one day
because
of these pyramid aliens.
Yeah. And further, which we'll get to. Furthermore, no one we see in the show can look at a figure in a geoglyph that has a head and a face and two arms and two legs and think simple human figure, because they leap out to, its proportions are weird. So this is probably a representation of an extraterrestrial.
Sure. Yeah.
So the show assumes that you're on board with the speculation that you will follow it anywhere, which is how we end up jumping around the globe to various examples of geoglyphs and pretty much unfounded speculation about how they are evidence of aliens. And like we said, it's true. The structure is, the show moves so fast that you'll be like, yes, pictures were an ancient form of written language. Yes, some pictographic imagery recurs across cultures. Yes, aliens told the ancient people which ones to use, and we need to figure out what sentences all these geoglyphs are spelling out.
Yeah. Like, it's basically our current news cycle as... as a theory to pass human culture.
That's right.
And it's just like, well, it's just like, well, you know, what about those top secret documents? Yeah, but what about the January 6th? What about this? What about that? And now here I am doing this thing. It's just like, well, I guess let's just roll with it because I can't fight it anymore.
No. So they get out of their depth by pointing to what they say are geoglyphs on Mars, like the big face. And I didn't know about this, but you said the face on Mars has already been debunked.
And they have since taken higher resolutions of it. It's sort of like taking it out of focus picture and you see the Hat Man in the background. You're like, oh, fuck, it's the Hat Man. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but even if it hadn't, to me, it looks like when you can, like you're looking at a wall with like a stucco texture.
Yeah.
And you can like, because your mind is looking for patterns.
Looking for faces,
Yes, yeah. You might see a face that you could like outline with, a, you know, a pencil or whatever.
Which, by the way, that is also an ancient astronaut theory. Why we see faces. Why are we it's in our DNA to recognize patterns of faces and things that aren't faces.
Mm-hmm.
Because of aliens.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So then they really, still on Mars, they really get out over their skis with this shit. Clip 5.
Of particular interest to researchers is a recently discovered geological anomaly that strongly resembles a species of bird.
In 2002, a member of the Cydonia Institute discovered a parrot formation in the RG Basin area of Mars. After two geologists and three veterinarians, one being an avian specialist, examined the formation, they confirmed that the parrot formation had over 17 points of anatomical correctness, all adhering to the proper shape, size, and orientation to a real parrot. The same motif can be seen on a copper plate produced by the Hopewell Indians that features the same type of parrot formation with an upraised wing.
Could the mysterious parrot-shaped formation on the surface of Mars really offer a link to the thousands of geoglyphs found here on Earth? And if so, does it offer evidence that extraterrestrials have been using them as a form of communication with humans for thousands of years? Ancient astronaut theorists say yes, and believe that the various geoglyphic depictions of animals, humans, and birds may not have been intended as mere artwork, but as a form of language whose message for mankind has yet to be decoded.
I mean, I just have nothing of but questions about this, starting with why ask an avian specialist about it? Like, what is an avian specialist going to say? Okay, yeah, I guess now that I see the lines you drew, I see where you get a parrot.
It just looks like, you know, bubbly lava field.
Yeah.
And then, like, the green lines start. And, of course, the green lines, some they draw, some they don't draw over.
Yes.
And then suddenly you have a parrot with one wing sticking out. And somebody says, yeah, sometimes in some native cultures, we have depictions of birds with their wings out.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, can you connect the dots between that and then aliens trying to teach us something? How is a parrot on fucking Mars supposed to teach us anything?
Right.
Never addressed.
No, never.
It was just, they were like, the aliens were like, all right, Roy, we're going to Earth. We're going to start teaching these idiots some shit about space birds. We want to make sure we get it right. So let's just practice here on this planet that's right before Earth, and then we'll go. So, all right, give me your best parrot.
You already alluded to this, so let's hear some more huge stretches in clip 6.
As described in the pyramid texts, ancient Egyptian religious texts that date back more than 4,000 years, a meteoric iron object called the Benben Stone was reported as having descended from the heavens like a firebird.
Even Egyptologists agree that this type of a
even those fuckers
shape descended from the sky and made a controlled landing. The Benben Stone opened and people walked out, the first creator gods. Now, when I hear a story like this, I wonder if this thing may have been some type of a craft, because it is very reminiscent of the top module of an Apollo rocket.
George, come on now.
This is the aliens guy talking with the hands. Aliens. That's that guy.
What Egyptologists, even they agree, it made a controlled landing and people came out. Like, there's a difference between saying that was the story or the legend or the myth.
That is the creation
right,
myth.
Versus...
But what if?
Yes. Versus something people literally saw occur. Yeah. And, like, got footage of on their iPhones uh-huh. in ancient Egypt. Like, yeah. What are you even talking about?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and the mm-hmm. animation of this to support George's evidence mm-hmm. is really, I mean, I can't say it's the worst thing I saw this week because we also watched Sharknado for the again with this Patreon, but it's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a little tiny pyramid with like little landing feet come out and it just gently touches down.
Yeah.
So. The episode and the reason this is relevant is because the myth is that the Benben stone landed on Earth covered in hieroglyphs mm-hmm. and that's where language came from. So
once again, unable to develop our own.
Right.
We need it gifted.
So I'm not going to cover every single beat, but the episode takes us through Nazca lines, of course.
Sure.
That's entry level. Coco Pelli and the Aztec star god Sisame, a Macedonian cosmic egg. The golden disks that are in space, the development of symbols to mark nuclear waste storage sites, a belt-shaped UFO with symbols carved on it that took off in England in the 80s before anyone could take a picture of that. Sure, that's real. But I'll leave it here, clip 7.
It may be that there's a sort of metaphysical time lock or a timeline for the decoding of the petroglyphs and geoglyphs. Maybe now is the time for us to fully understand what those messages are.
Perhaps the keys to breaking the alien code are all around us and have been hiding in plain sight for thousands of years. All we need to do to unlock their mystery is to see them from the same perspective as our extraterrestrial ancestors. We must look at them from the sky.
Okay.
Closed, I think you meant.
So, Dave, is there anything that is very significant that you feel I have left out of this recounting?
I mean, without going into each example and how dumb it was, I mean, I think you nailed it. I mean,
yes.
Baton toss between segments where they never resolve any of their theories because it's just a never-ending move to the next one.
Yep.
Frankly, I think Trump was like watching this. He's like, I gotta do that. You know, like I just never end insanity is just the way to
yeah.
keep out of trouble. Just always outrun it. You do get a little exhausted sometimes watching this show because they do go like through 10 things where they're like, and therefore it means something. Maybe this next thing could prove. It's basically saying, you know, we're gonna cook a meal and we're gonna start off, we're gonna bake some bread and we're going to have flour and this and that. And how does it all work? How do we make all these things into bread? Well, maybe this piece of celery holds the answer. And then in the next segment, they're making salad and you never find out how they make bread. That's ancient alien.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly it. It's like, what if this, and then they find a person to say this is, and then they just move on to the next, like vaguely connected, you know. It is a daisy chain. I've run out of analogies. Daisy chain is another one, but like they don't really, it doesn't really build to anything because it starts from a premise of like this thing we are talking about is evidence that aliens are real, and then it just looks for as many examples as it can and finds as many kooks as it can to be like, totally. The fact that these people, you know, like David Childress, like George, like, you know, the others that keep reappearing in more and more episodes, that they feel like they are equally qualified to talk about geoglyphs in South America as they are to talk about why the founding fathers were all aliens. Like, they just, it's incredible how broad and shallow.
Yeah.
their areas of fake expertise are that they are, you know, called upon to comment on the huge variety across 19 seasons of the fucking show. 223 episodes about various things that are all proof of ancient aliens.
They made a show out of a bunch of stoner friends getting together, getting fucking out of their gourd and just talking about shit they had no business actually speculating on in any sort of professional way.
Yes.
And now they're all making bank on it. So mm-hmm. in one case, like, you know, who's the fool here? Do they actually believe all this? I think they do, but also they figured out a way to make a little money off of it. And
yes.
like, I'm sure they never stop going to cons. Like, they are basically
oh, yeah.
the D-tier Ahura, you know, just always somewhere in Wisconsin and Arizona, just signing their books that were self-published on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And that is it. And they're yep. making a decent living out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Ancient astronaut theorists say, yes, please.
That's right.